Welcome to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. Stay tuned for an analysis and conversation about the issues that matter most to you and your family. Here now with this week's edition of News in Focus is Chris Long.
And good afternoon and welcome to this edition of News in Focus. Well, this week, Cleveland played host to not only the playoff series as New York Yankees came in to play the Cleveland Indians, but it also played host to the first presidential debate of 2020 as President Donald Trump and Joe Biden faced off against each other on the campus of Case Western Reserve University, hosted by Case Western and the Cleveland Clinic. Now, of course, there was fireworks with this debate as both men went at each other, and also the moderator seemed to insert himself, and that was Chris Wallace of Fox News. We're going to talk about it and break down the debate, talk about the pros, the cons, the good, the bad, the ugly, with Brian Williams, who is the chairman of the Republican Party of Summit County. But we also want to tell you that the voting registration deadline is October 5th. This Sunday constitutes the last Citizenship Sunday opportunity for you to conduct a voter registration effort at your church. The materials for that are available on our website at ohioca.org. You can just download the voter registration form, the application for absentee ballot for those who will be voting absentee. And of course, Monday night at 9 p.m. is when voting registration closes if you're going to participate in the November 3rd election. So it's very critical that you do that. Now, another way you could do it is ohiovote.gov. That's ohiovote.gov. And again, that link is on our website as well, that you can register or update your voter registration online at the Secretary of State's online platform of ohiovote.gov. Let's go to a sound clip right now from last night. And this was a question put to Mr. Biden, because there has been discussion, if the Democrat was to win, to pack the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll talk about what that means, but let's go to that clip right now.
Are you willing to tell the American people tonight whether or not you will support either ending the filibuster or packing the court?
Whatever position I take in that, that'll become the issue. The issue is the American people should speak. You should go out and vote. You're in voting now. Vote and let your senators know how strongly you feel. Vote now.
Are you going to pack the
court? Make sure you, in fact, let people know.
He doesn't want to answer the question.
I'm not going to answer the question.
Why would you answer that
question? The question is, will you shut up, man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on your
so
list?
Right.
Gentlemen,
this
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
He's going to pack the court.
We have
not going to give a list.
We have ended this segment. We're going to move on to the second segment.
That was really a productive segment, wasn't it?
Well, that was a little bit of the exchange last night. Things started contentious very quickly as the moderator started with a very contentious question to Mr. Trump. And that basically set the tone for the evening. Here to break it down with us is Brian Williams, again, the chairman of the Summit County Republican Party. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Chris. It's good to be here.
Well, thank you, Brian. You and I chatted a little bit this morning about the debate, and we had some review of the debate. Tell us your thoughts of the debate. What are some things that stood out to you?
Well, it was very argumentative on both sides. Chris Wallace, I think he did. I agree with you. He did interject himself as a factor in the debate. You know, the old-fashioned way of saying it is he put his finger on the scale in two ways. One, in the ways in which he did and did not interrupt certain people at certain times. And then with the questions he asked and the questions he didn't ask. I was distracted as a listener by the constant interrupting of both candidates back and forth. I think it was unproductive to both of them, and I think they should have had more voluntary restraint within the process.
Well, I thought, you know, this was a debate that I watched from start to finish, and you would think that in my role as the president of the Ohio Christian Alliance, we'd hear a lot of these debates over the years I have, but I haven't really watched a debate fully since the last Cleveland debate of 2015, when President, well, then it was Citizen Trump, was going up against a whole field of Republican interested candidates at that time back in 2015. But this was an interesting debate for sure, because there was so much going into this. Would Joe Biden show up? Because for months, he's been in his basement. He's been social distancing. He's not been going out to large crowds. He's been really hiding from the public because of coronavirus. This is what he says. President Trump, conversely, has been out there. He's been out there in the public. He's been holding large meetings and gatherings. I was at a large gathering on Saturday in Washington, D.C. Upwards of 100,000 people came to the mall in Washington to fast and to pray and to seek the face of God, praying for our nation. It was not a political event. It was really a prayer event, and it was a wonderful event. And so obviously, you know, Christians wanted to come. There were people that were wearing their masks, but by and large, these are people that have social distanced for months and did all the things that we've been told to do by medical experts, but they wanted to get out and do something positively and to pray for our nation. That happened on Saturday. Conversely, the president has been getting out and holding large rallies with thousands of people in attendance. Mr. Biden has not. So the question was he going to even come out and debate? Well, he did. I think that for a lot of people, because the bar was set so low of how he would do, because he has had some gaffes. He has actually had some memory issues, it seems like, at times on the stage in debates, and people are wondering how he would perform. He is the oldest known American to run for office. He's 78, so that would constitute the oldest person ever run for the presidency. But he seemed to hold his own last night with the president. But they basically were combative, and they went at it. We don't have any sound bites to continue, but they're out there on the Internet. You can see them and hear them. But, you know, there were several exchanges I want to get in with you, and that question particularly about packing the court. What was Chris Wallasting referencing in that packing the court, that question to Joe Biden? What was he meaning?
Well, what he's saying is that if the Republicans follow up and confirm the Supreme Court nominee prior to the election or prior to the next president taking office, in other words, giving the public the chance to elect Joe Biden and let somebody else make the nomination, they will, if they win, they being the Democrats, would add three judges to the Supreme Court, and that way Joe Biden would have three automatic picks out of the gate. They would all be liberal activists, and that would then sway the balance of the court back. There are some people that suggest that that a potential President Biden and a potential Senate majority should add six Supreme Court judges all at once, eliminate the Senate filibuster, ram it through, and for at least 2 years be able to do whatever they want at the Supreme Court level, because six activist liberal judges plus the three that are already there would be able to nullify any of the Trump appointees.
Well, we have nine justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. Has that always been the number of justices? How did we come up with that number? And why would there be a suggestion of adding more? And could they constitutionally do that? That's a question in and of itself, isn't it?
They can. The number is set not by the Constitution, but the number is set by legislation. We've had nine Supreme Court justices for the past 150 years, and it is within the purview of Congress, along with the signature by the Senate, by the president, you know, had to pass a piece of legislation to add judges or subtract them for that matter. But we've had nine now for over 150 years. And there have been times Franklin Roosevelt tried to pack the Supreme Court after a conservative majority kept striking down his New Deal policies as unconstitutional. And they resisted, and that idea kind of didn't happen. And at that point, no one has tried since to add judges to the Supreme Court.
Well, last night, of course, yeah, and that was the suggestion in the question, of course, and that is very alarming to stop and think about that, because we look for 150 years of precedent where there's been nine justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. President Trump, it looks as if, is going to get an opportunity to appoint three. He's already appointed two. Ruth Bader Ginsburg passed away last week, and now there is a nominee that he has put forward that will be considered by the U.S. Senate. And so the liberal left in this country and those who support abortion rights and abortion on demand, they are panicking because it looks as if Roe v. Wade would be challenged and struck down if Amy Barrett is confirmed to the U.S. Supreme Court. But folks, stay tuned, because that's going to play out here in the next weeks and few months. But Brian, let's look at some of the specifics of last night. Again, for those who are looking for a civil debate, Mr. Trump, of course, is a fighter. He is not one to just be polite when he feels he's being attacked. He will attack in return. That's been Trump. And, you know, as they say, let Trump be Trump. Well, I think the Democrats chose Joe Biden because among their field, he is known as Fighting Joe. And that may be why they chose him as their nominee, as someone who could step up and be combative with Trump. But actually, last night, it really played out in full scale. And I think the moderator did insert an incivility with his first attacking question of the president. It didn't start soft. It started aggressive right away, and it set the tone for the evening. I think the moderator, really, if people were not happy with the tone last night, I think a lot of fault goes to Chris Wallace in the way that he conducted himself as a moderator. But that aside, let's talk about some of the things that were brought up. For the first time, and I've been doing this for two decades, I've never heard a presidential candidate shift his position on a major policy issue at a debate. That happened last night, where Joe Biden reversed himself on the Green New Deal. He said he does not support the Green New Deal. He said, I've got my own plan. And when asked again and reiterated, he said, no, I don't support the Green New Deal by that the radical left in his party is pushing. What were your thoughts on that moment?
Yeah, it was a complete about face for him to separate himself from the Green New Deal. He, all throughout the debates against the Democrats in the primary, he, like the others, said he supports it. In fact, on his Biden for President website, he says the Green New Deal is critical that we consider it, implement it, and move forward with it. So as we speak right now, 18 hours after his comments on the debate last night, he is at odds with his own campaign website on that position. And I think it's a demonstration that Joe Biden is trying to be the typical two-faced politician. He is saying one thing to his liberal, leftist, radical base, but to a large national audience who does not agree with the Green New Deal, who understands that it is economic chaos, government control, and mandate over people's lives, he is trying to distance himself from it. And the question is, will he get away with it? Can he be... In the digital age where people have access to the computer and to the internet and to Facebook and to all sorts of social media and cable news, can Joe Biden get away with that two-faced approach to campaigning?
Last night, a question came up because of the unrest that we have seen in the streets of America with all the protests that turned into riots in city after city from New York to the West Coast. Last night was brought up some of the antagonistic groups that have actually been in the streets doing that. Of course, Antifa, Black Lives Matter, the radical element of Black Lives Matter, with some of the really destruction that's gone on in American cities from Chicago to L.A. to New York and to Portland and Seattle. Last night, it was saying, will you designate Antifa and KKK as terrorist organizations? The president has come out and said he'll do just that. What were your thoughts about that exchange last night? Because Antifa was not even allowed to be said. Quickly, the moderator spoke over the president. Joe Biden, at the same time, there's almost like they were shouting at it. It's like that was verboten that you couldn't mention the word Antifa. What were your thoughts on that?
Well, I couldn't figure it out. I don't know what's so precious about calling out Antifa as a terrorist organization within the country. They are radical. They are violent. And maybe they don't have a headquarters. Maybe they don't have dues-paying members. Maybe they don't have officers. But it is a movement, and it represents a political point of view that is both violent and illegal and anti-American. They hate capitalism, and they probably don't like democracy. But I couldn't figure it out why they were shouted down. And I thought President Trump was right to try and pin down Biden in a way that Wallace would not, and say, well, what do you say about Black Lives Matter? And do Black Lives Matter or do all lives matter? Do you disassociate yourself and condemn Antifa and Black Lives Matter when they take on these violent and destructive and looting measures that they like to call peaceful protests. And yeah, he was cut off. And that's a great example of how the moderator interjected himself in the discussion.
Well, there was another thing about, we talked about the incivility last night. Mr. Biden actually told the president, shut up. He also called him a racist, and he also called him a clown. I mean, it was name-calling by Mr. Biden to our president. The president did not, in return. He did say that Mr. Biden was a liar. But other than that, the name-calling came from the left side. It came from Mr. Biden. What were your thoughts about that? Because we've never seen that at that level displayed on a national stage in a presidential debate before. Your thoughts?
It was very hard to watch as an American, regardless of who the president is and what their party is. It's very difficult to watch your president being disrespected in that way. I get the fact that they were debating and they were going each other. It started out when they walked out on stage. They agreed not to shake hands because of COVID, convenient excuse. And then Joe Biden said to the president, hey, man, how you doing? And I knew it was going to be all downhill from there. It didn't take long. But what really frosted me about that uncivil and pathetic exchange when those things happened, when he called the president a clown twice, when he told him to shut up, is that Chris Wallace's silence was very, very apparent. In what world would a moderator not admonish and stop that name calling? I guarantee you that if the president had if the shoe was on the other foot and the president had called Joe Biden a clown, my guess is that Chris Wallace would have moved in immediately and shut it down. And that's just another fine example of how Wallace was, quite frankly, in the tank for Biden at the expense of the president.
People were wondering, because we know of the left leanings of Mr. Wallace. We know he can be antagonistic on his Sunday morning program for sure. His father is a well-known liberal leftist from 60 Minute days. But the point is that last night he was to be moderator. He was to be neutral. He was to give both men probing questions, difficult questions. That mission was not accomplished. And at times it looked as if the president was debating two people, the moderator and his opponent, Mr. Biden. That was clear and evident, mm-hmm. and it was known out on the internet as well. People saw that. Who are basically the undecided, and there are some independents out there. One of the things that was interesting, though, I think most of us say that debate was almost a draw. Each got their points in. It didn't really move the ball one way or the other, but it's interesting because there's Hispanic communities and news feeds that are showing that the president won by 60-some percent. And what's interesting about that, Brian, is I thought last night to myself is that last night was reminiscent of what you'd see in other countries, maybe in Europe or Eastern Europe or maybe in Central America type of style of debate. And maybe those folks are used to more competitive or combative type debating, like in the Parliament, of course, in England as well, where they do talk over each other. And I think for those folks, they could read between the lines, see what was being said and how it was being delivered, and they favored the president. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think so. Well, maybe that. I think you're right that politics in the United States historically has been more genteel in the last 100 years, since the turn of the century, than other countries. That is true. Also, I think that if you just pay attention to the subtitles, if you're listening to the debate and it's being translated and you're reading the teletype, it's clear Donald Trump spoke more on message, on substance, than Joe Biden did. Joe Biden had a few answers that just meandered around, didn't know what he was saying. There were a bunch of platitudes. He did stand up in defense of his $4 trillion tax increase, saying it would be a good job producer, which is utterly laughable. But President Trump spoke substantively, even when he was attacking Biden, for instance, with his son Hunter Biden, saying, what did your son do to get $3.5 million from the widow of a Russian oligarch or the mayor of Russia? You know, and so I could see why, if all you're reading is the translation at the bottom, you would think that President Trump won that debate.
There was another issue, too, that came up of judicial nominees. And the president pointed out and said, when you and Mr. Obama left office, you left 126 openings of federal judges. He said, thank you. I was able to fill those seats. And I think for somebody who's a liberal and a supporter of Mr. Obama, who wants more of a liberal philosophy on the court, would be grimace in thinking, why did you people incompetently leave those seats open as you left office? You had an opportunity of a few months to fill those vacancies, and you didn't do that. So I thought that was a zinger last night. Your thoughts?
It's a great point. It's a great point. But there's a reason why the Obama administration left so many federal vacancies. They thought for sure Hillary Clinton was going to win and that the Democrats were going to take over the U.S. Senate. And they did not want to offer up under the last 2 years of President Obama, when the Republicans had the Senate, they did not want to offer up moderate centrist judges who were known to be have some fidelity with the Constitution and have some level of judicial restraint. They wanted it all. They wanted liberal activist judges on the federal judiciary, up and down the level of the judiciary, and they were willing to wait for Hillary Clinton to get in. They gambled. They lost. The American people spoke. They wanted President Trump, and they gave us a Republican majority in the U.S. Senate, which was expanded upon, not diminished in terms of number in 2016. So, you know, when Joe Biden says the American people should get to speak, they did speak in 2016 when they elected President Trump and they elected a Republican majority Senate. And those are the judges. And to President Trump's credit, he kept his word and he worked off a list of federal judges that he gave, or federal candidates for federal judgeship that he gave during the campaign. A real sign of being a new type of politician, which is, here's my promise. I'm going to live up to my promise when I get in office. And he did that. Something that Trump or Biden was challenged to do last night, which he would never do in a million years, because if he gave you a list of names of the judges that he would nominate, they would be the subject of ridicule, and they would scare the American people, and they would motivate votes against him. And so that's why he's keeping that list under wraps. And I just think it's another great point as to why Trump had to do two things last night. Trump had to raise the points that Wallace would not in his probative questions against Joe Biden, and he had to defend himself. And I think he did so well in that front.
We're talking with Brian Williams. He is the chairman of the Summit County Republican Party. Brian, thank you for coming on and giving us your views on last night's debate. Whether there'll be two more debates remains to be seen. We'll see what happens as the campaigns will wrangle about as to where the next debate will be scheduled. We do know that the two vice presidential, Mr. Pence and, of course, Ms. Harris, will face off next week in a vice presidential debate. We'll see whether there's a second or third presidential debate. Well, if you want to know where the candidates stand on the issue, the Ohio Christian Alliance is nonpartisan and has an educational voter guide that's available on our website at ohioca.org. The PDF is there. You can download it. You can also order voter guides for your church. They are C3 friendly. They can be distributed because we don't endorse political parties or candidates. But we provide educational resources as the Ohio Christian Alliance Voter Guide. We cover the presidential, congressional, Ohio House, and Ohio Senate, and share that information with your friends. Again, Brian, thanks for being my guest today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. God bless. And folks, if you missed any of today's program, you can hear it in its entirety on our website at ohioca.org. Stay tuned as I interview Ron O'Brien, the Franklin County prosecutor, who actually has filed charges against those who have committed damages at the Ohio State House. Stay tuned.
Hi, this is David Barton of Wall Builders. Our God-given rights of religious freedom are under attack in America today as never before. But Christians can do something about this. We have a right to vote. And in fact, we have a duty to vote. And we must vote. And we must vote for candidates who will support our basic Christian values. Since 1787, it's been our responsibility to select those who will govern us. Yet today, nearly 50% of Christians do not vote. Are you a registered voter in Ohio? If not, you can register to vote online at www.voteohio.gov. That's www.voteohio.gov. You can also register in person at your county board of elections, but you must register to vote by October the 5th in Ohio. October the 5th, that's the deadline. Please be sure to register and then vote. And please join me in praying for our country.
Paid for by One Nation Under God Foundation, a tax-exempt 501c3 committee. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity.
And the soldiers who stormed the beaches of Normandy and the Allied liberation of Europe. On D-Day, all those warriors set out on their mission. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt led our nation in prayer.
The D-Day Prayer Project is an effort to add FDR's D-Day prayer in its entirety at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. This wonderful historical presidential prayer will be a lasting tribute to our World War II veterans. If you'd like to make a contribution towards the effort of adding this prayer to the memorial, go to the website at ddayprayerproject.org. That's ddayprayerproject.org.
Welcome to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, president of the Ohio Christian Alliance. Stay tuned for an analysis and conversation about the issues that matter most to you and your family. Here now with this week's edition of News in Focus is Chris Long.
And good afternoon and welcome to this edition of News in Focus. We're glad that you've joined us. We're going to be talking about what happened in Columbus earlier this year during the protests that turned riots in downtown Columbus. And of course, Columbus hosts our state capitol, where our state capitol is, the state Supreme Court, Rhodes Center, which is where the Attorney General's offices are, and other state offices. And on May 28th, there was a protest that turned riots that became very destructive in downtown Columbus. We've reported that on this program. And of course, as the State House itself became the target of severe vandalism that night, as windows were broken and the front door was compromised, and actually anarchists at that point entered the building. There was only a handful of highway patrol on guard that night and had needed assistance by Columbus police to discharge those who had broken into the building. Again, on June 18th, there was another act of vandalism, again, which we have reported on this program, and that was in broad daylight, as protesters then went onto the State House grounds with buckets of paint and began to smear the pillars, the steps, the monuments, the state motto on the State House grounds, actually creating damages that amounted upwards of $160,000. And that price has gone up of what it's going to pay charge the taxpayers. Well, the city prosecutor did not follow through with, as the arrests were made, at least on May 28th, there were no arrests immediately on June 18th. But we have a report for you, an update. But let's go to that Channel 6 report of when this all first happened. This is ABC Channel 6 in Columbus.
The State House has been a repeated target, and Governor DeWine is vowing to put a stop to it. Jeff Reddick live at the State House tonight with more. So, Jeff, how does he plan to do that?
Well, you're going to see a lot more armed presence from troopers with the Ohio State Highway Patrol. For example, you can see them now. 4 to 6 of them have been posted by the McKinley Monument here out front. They're also posted at the main entrances to the State House. And way up there, you can see they're also still posted outside the Columbus Monument, which has seen some vandalism, too. This is all a much greater police presence than we had seen over the last 2 weeks. And that's because vandals had again splashed paint, including red handprints and words against police, across the building last week. It eventually took a private company to wash off much of the vandalism. This is a part of protesting that the governor believes has no place in Columbus. He says he will not tolerate it, and neither will the highway patrol.
My instructions to them is that when there is vandalism, when there is any act that's illegal, they are to investigate it, and they are to take that, once they get the case, and to take that prosecution, and we're going to seek prosecution.
The governor had also noted that small businesses in Columbus have seen vandalism as well. He said that that is also not to be tolerated because these are businesses owned by men and women who've put work into them for many years and don't deserve to see their dreams dashed by vandals. Now, the governor also said he had spoken with Mayor Ginther, about what's gone on in the city and says that he's instructed the highway patrol to also take action against anybody who carries out any kind of violence out here where protests have happened. Violence against police, he says, will also not be tolerated near the grounds of the State House and will be prosecuted as well. Live at the State House, I'm Jeff Reddick, ABC 6 News.
And of course, that was a report by ABC Channel 6 in Columbus earlier this summer. Since that time, of course, the city attorney has not followed through with arrests and or prosecutions, even though there were arrests on the night of May 28th. There were 14 arrests originally on May 28th of the damages at the State House, but those charges were dropped, were not pursued by the city attorney. Now, the county prosecutor is Ron O'Brien. He's with us on the phone, and he did take up the cause, and he has pursued the investigation. Let me read this to you from the Highway Patrol after that the governor had made a statement. In fact, the governor stated this: I have spoken with Ohio State Highway Patrol Colonel Richard Fambro about security at the Ohio State House, and I shared with him my anger and disgust at the vandalism that occurred there yesterday. I support the right to peacefully protest. However, defacing, damaging, and vandalizing our state capitol and its grounds are wrong, and such actions are criminal. The Ohio State Highway Patrol is conducting a criminal investigation into these yesterday's acts, and they will send their findings to the appropriate authorities for potential prosecution. Well, we have good news in that there has been indictments that have come down. Arrests have been made. Indictments have come down. And really, that's thanks in large part to the gentleman that's on the phone with me right now. And that's Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien. Mr. O'Brien, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate the invitation to talk a little bit about these cases that arose from the protests and the riots here in Columbus.
You know, you had talked about when we were on the phone and talked about downtown these days recently has looked like a war zone as many buildings have been boarded up due to all the broken glass on the frontage of many businesses and restaurants downtown. And being a public policy representative myself with the Ohio Christian Alliance, representing people of faith across the state in the many travels that I've taken to Columbus and to our State House, it was really disturbing to see our state capitol and the downtown area look this way. Your thoughts?
Well, I think what I used in our conversation is exactly how it looked. It looked like a war zone with plywood and boards all over buildings in the downtown area, whether they are office buildings, churches, restaurants, and broken glass laying on the ground in front until it was cleaned up. We had the problem that you related to where actually someone was arrested inside the State House in Auditor Keith Faber's office in the State House, and others who went in after they took a heavy iron trash can and broke out a window in the State House on the side that faces High Street, and actually crawled through the window there and were arrested inside. So we have taken, much like the news clip that you just played for your listeners, I at least have taken the view that certainly everybody has a right to protest peacefully, and most of the people here in downtown Columbus were protesting peacefully and exercising their First Amendment rights, but there were some others that used that peaceful process as a vehicle to engage in violent conduct, to vandalize businesses, vandalize the State House, and other property. And if we could prove a case, I told the Highway Patrol, the Columbus Police, and actually I was working with the Columbus Police daily through this time frame, that if we have a case and someone's engaged in violent conduct or property damage, we want to prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law. And we have, I think, to date, 20 indictments against individuals who engaged in various crimes of either vandalism, arson, looting, robbery, and fleeing the police when the police may chase them, weapons offenses. We had one man who was arrested on the corner where City Hall sits at Broad and Front with a AK-47 kind of weapon, and we indicted him for he was on probation for robbery.
Huh.
We indicted him for having a weapon under disability, being the prior robbery conviction. And actually, after his arrest and indictment here, we worked with a federal prosecutor, Dave DeVillers, who used to be in charge of our gang unit here in our office. He was appointed by President Trump to be the United States Attorney last year. And we dropped our case because he took the case federally, where the penalty can be up to 20 years in prison if you're a felon in possession of a firearm in a riotous kind of situation. So we have tried to work not only with the FBI on people that we believed had traveled to Columbus to engage in violent conduct as part of infiltrating the protests, and the U.S. Attorney's Office, Columbus Police, and the Highway Patrol, and agree wholeheartedly with Governor DeWine that violent conduct as part of the protest won't be tolerated if we can prove it. As you might suspect, and here's part of the problem, Chris, is people who were engaging in this conduct, even if the police had on body cams or if you have surveillance video, they were wearing masks because of the pandemic, and you were having difficulty identifying who they were. And that's what took us so long to charge the people that defaced with red paint the statehouse grounds you talked about earlier.
Let's talk about that in just a minute, about because there's two dates of real incidents. May 28th, of course, was the major rioting that took place in downtown Columbus. We previously had on this program members of the NAACP of Ohio, Pastor John Coates, who serves as an officer of the state commission, and he said, we were not invited to this so-called peaceful protest. He said, I went down there. I heard about it on the news that night. I am a resident of Columbus, he says, a longtime resident. I went downtown to see what was happening, and he said, I saw instruments of destruction. I saw frozen water bottles. I saw boards with nails in them. I saw pallets with concrete. And he said, I saw people urging others to commit acts of vandalism and destruction and rioting downtown. He eyewitnessed that. We put that in a report we called War Zone Columbus, still boarded up. And we took the eyewitness reports that we had gleaned by talking to law enforcement, actually, that were on duty that night, that the men that actually arrested those at the State House, that also people who live downtown in condominium units. And, you know, it's block after block after block. And I know, Ron, you care about your county. You care about this city. And I know it breaks your heart to see it. And, you know, obviously we agree with the right of peaceful protest, but this wasn't. This was anarchy. And it was those who actually, there were outside agitators, according to some, that came in to actually instigate and urge people on for destruction. But the State House itself is a symbol of the people's house, of where we do peaceful civil dialogue. We may disagree on issues, but we do it in a peaceful way of exchange. That is our form of representative government. And for that to show 26 windows broken out, all the first floor windows broken out that night, the front doors compromised, destruction that took place inside, is very disturbing indeed. And we appreciate that you have followed up where city government actually has failed the state government in not pursuing prosecutions of these individuals. Your office has pursued them, and we're appreciative of that. You know, I was able to obtain a police report through our network of volunteers. It was actually the call log, the Columbus police call log from May 28th that night. It's 35 pages long. It basically is the transmission between the officers in the street back with dispatch, with each line item of each alarm, Ron, that went off in every building that was going off, because those alarms go back to the police station. It's 35 pages of it. And then, of course, all the different destruction that was going on. Your office is pursuing. How many indictments do we have right now from those who have committed destruction? What's your office have? 20?
It's a total of 20 individuals that are indicted. Some of the indictments have multiple counts. For example, disrupting public services, inducing panic, vandalism, and tampering with evidence because they attempted to dispose of the pellet gun they used to shoot out the window of the bus. That's just one case I mentioned. But the most egregious case I would like to tell you about is a fella who, on his way downtown, decided to come downtown. He stopped at a corner grocery store, bought some lighter fluid, some Corona beer, and some socks, went outside, dumped the beer out of the bottles, put the lighter fluid in the bottles, and then put the socks in the bottles as a wick, and came downtown with his with six Molotov cocktails he made, carrying them, walked downtown. When he got in the area of Broad and Grant, or between Grant and Cleveland Avenue, he started throwing these Molotov cocktails after he lit the socks at police officers who were wearing riot gear, as luckily they were. And over a period of the next several hours, he threw rocks, bottles, Molotov cocktails at police. And then, and luckily this is on social media, he broke into the Adam H. Building, which is the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, Mental Health Agency for Franklin County. He broke into the building, and we have that on video, and he set a couch in the lobby on fire, and you can actually see him standing over this fire that is arching upward, and we ended up, when everything was put out by the fire department, both the fire and water damage was $250,000. Luckily, this person, because we had his photo on social media, we were able to identify him, arrest him, and he's charged with aggravated arson. He's charged with felonious assault for attempting to cause harm to the officers by throwing Molotov cocktails at him. He also lit on fire a nearby building after he started the fire on the couch in the Adam H. building. And here, what was that doing to remedy the incidents that he or anybody else was protesting? It was just violent conduct that luckily didn't cause harm, serious harm to officers, and then burning down a county building that's designed to service those that need help the most. It's just disturbing, understates it.
Is that individual being held in jail while he awaits trial?
He was in jail, and we filed a motion he be held in jail, but there was a very large bond set, too. I'm going to say $1 million. I think it was $1.5 million by the municipal court judge. But when he got over to common pleas court, the bond was reduced. It was still substantial, and his family posted it. So he is out of jail and actually is, they say, in some kind of rehab treatment program. But he is not in jail. He was probably for maybe 2 or 3 weeks after his original arrest.
And he is awaiting trial on these very serious charges.
This is Albert Boler with another word about the upcoming election. There is so much at stake. We might not be able to vote as conveniently as we have voted before, but that just puts on Christian citizens the responsibility to work even harder to make sure that we vote and that our vote counts. Too much is at stake to sit this election out. So, whatever it takes, go vote.
Hi, this is David Barton of Wall Builders. Our God-given rights of religious freedom are under attack in America today as never before. But Christians can do something about this. We have a right to vote. And in fact, we have a duty to vote. And we must vote. And we must vote for candidates who will support our basic Christian values. Since 1787, it's been our responsibility to select those who will govern us. Yet today, nearly 50% of Christians do not vote. Are you a registered voter in Ohio? If not, you can register to vote online at www.voteohio.gov. That's www.voteohio.gov. You can also register in person at your county board of elections. but you must register to vote by October the 5th in Ohio. October the 5th, that's the deadline. Please be sure to register and then vote. And please join me in praying for our country.
Paid for by One Nation Under God Foundation, a tax-exempt 501c3 committee.
We're talking with Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien. And, of course, Franklin County is where the city of Columbus is in central Ohio and where our state government is hosted. And, of course, unfortunately, the scene of riots on May 28th and then again on June 18th as paint vandalism took place to the state house. Now, Ron, as we heard on that audio clip earlier in the program, this paint actually they had to hire a contractor with special equipment when they first came out to try to power wash it out. The next couple of days, they realized that the power wash unit was destroying some of the sandstone, so they had to rethink how they were going to do it, and they had to hire and acquire some special equipment for the paint removal. This is not just simple, you know, paint, and of course, you know, this was really expensive damages, and between the broken windows and the paint vandalism, it amounted to $160,000, but that cost is bound to go higher. You have some indictments on the June 18th event. Let's talk about that, the painting incident. In fact, in other words, we could say you caught them red-handed. Tell us how that happened.
Yes, actually, how the people were identified, because the Ohio Patrol stopped some people who were heading towards the steps in the front of the state house and thought that they had, you know, prevented them from doing that. And while they went inside, another group arrived and they painted, put their hands in the red paint in the cans, and then put their red paint handprints on those probably 6-inch diameter columns that are across the front of the state house, and then on these steps, probably 8 or 10, 12 steps, some of that is marble, going up to enter the state house, which that material was porous, and so when you got paint on it, it went into the columns and went into the concrete and the marble, and was very difficult, as you just mentioned, to remove. So they had and did hire a special cleaning crew to do that, and they did get it cleaned up, but the delay in getting some charges filed on that, and actually on the fellow that broke into the state house, the question initially was it a criminal trespass, which is a misdemeanor that would be handled by the city attorney's office, or was it something more serious such as vandalism with damage to government property that would make it a felony where we would handle it? And so we did further investigation, first trying to identify the people, and luckily the people that had the red paint in front of the state house, they bragged about it to some news media, and we were able to, through that process, identify who two of them were. And then the Highway Patrol and the Columbus Police reviewed their body cams to see if they could see who the individuals may have been that were, and they identified two other people that way. So right now there are three people charged with vandalism, criminal damage, and criminal mischief for the red paint incident, and there is a fourth that we have a file on who's not yet been charged, but he was just identified through that process of looking at the surveillance video, which I might add, as a result of these incidents, we found that the surveillance cameras inside the state house itself were old enough that they were very poor pictures, and you actually couldn't identify the people that were trespassing in the state house after they broke in. And I've had a conversation with Senator Andrew Brenner, who is going to get some money in the budget this year to improve the surveillance cameras.
That's right, high-resolution cameras for the state house.
Exactly, because we'll have a robbery at a small grocery store, and they had better video equipment to identify the robber of a small corner grocery store than they had in our state house, which I found somewhat amazing, Chris.
Well, that's right. And
kudos to Andrew Brenner, who is a longtime a public servant here in Central Ohio that he's picking it up and doing something over it.
Well, and he has a bill right now that will make it a third-degree felony for anyone committing acts of vandalism or destruction at state property. That would include the State House, the State Supreme Court, the Road Center, the anything to do with the Auditor's Office, Attorney General, Secretary of State, or any statue display of the state. It would be a third-degree felony. And then again, there was vandalism, paint vandalism, to the war memorials at the State House and our state motto. This is what was very disturbing of what, you know, people saw in the reports in the media. And of course, we reported as an organization because we encourage people to go to the State House to weigh in on public policy and to share with legislators your views on public policy. And so for this to the State House, after 163 years without any known vandalism that like we have seen this year on May 28th and June 18th. So it is good to know that somebody is taking the reins here and is going to prosecute those who committed these damages. Mr. Prosecutor, we appreciate that. Obviously, if these people are convicted, they're looking at jail time. Yes?
Yes, yes. All of the people we had, and I might tell you, there were 141 arrests. 122 of them were misdemeanors, and 19 were felonies. And so far, we have indicted 20 people out of the protests and riots. And
well,
so
we're
happy with that result.
Very good. And so we'll make your press release available. Also, information will be available to our website. We've run out of time, but thanks for being my guest today.
Well, thank you for the invitation, and good luck with your fine work.
Thank you. And again, that's County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien from Franklin County. We'll be right back after these messages. Don't go away.
You have been listening to News in Focus with your host, Chris Long, President of the Ohio Christian Alliance. To learn more about the issues that matter most to you and your family, visit online at ohioca.org. That's ohioca.org. Thank you for listening. This program is sponsored by the Ohio Christian Alliance of Akron, Ohio.